Welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, co-host of the Trauma Super Conference. Today, I'm speaking with Andrew Penn, a University of California, San Francisco trained psychiatric nurse practitioner. He serves as an associate clinical professor in the School of Nursing and practices at the San Francisco Department of Veterans Affairs. Andrew completed extensive training in psychedelic assisted therapy and has worked as a study therapist on a phase 3 MDMA assisted therapy protocol for PTSD. And is co-investigator of a study on psilocybin-assisted therapy for major depression. He's a nationally recognized speaker on psychedelic-assisted therapy and cannabinoids in psychiatry and the co-founder of the Organization of Psychedelic and Entheogenic Nurses, Open Nurses. Andrew Penn, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me, Megan.
Let's start with the elephant in the room. What are psychedelic drugs and why are they being studied as supplements to psychotherapy?
Yeah, so psychedelic drugs comprise a broad category of different compounds. But broadly speaking, we're talking with regards to psychiatry about MDMA, which is methylenedioxymethamphetamine. That's a mouthful, which is known colloquially as Molly or ecstasy for the treatment of PTSD, and psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms for the treatment of largely for depression, but we're also looking at it in certain substance use disorders as well. So the important thing to remember about both of these modalities is that these are used to catalyze psychotherapy. They're not used as a drug just by itself, which is really important to underscore that. This is different than how we do pharmacology traditionally, where you take a pill to get an effect, and it may or may not be accompanied by psychotherapy. And in both of these models, the medication is used to really enhance and catalyze a psychotherapy process.
That's a really important distinction that you make, because it's, and I love that you reminded us of kind of the precedent of, you know, medication and medication assisted anything in this country and around the world is you have a problem and you take something to fix it. And whereas these types of treatments are alongside therapy. And so if you could kind of tease that apart for me, and I know you mentioned it very briefly, but which drug is best for which kind of the thing that you're trying to get somebody through in psychotherapeutic treatment?
Yeah, well, why don't we start with talking about PTSD, since that seems most germane to the conference here. So yeah. MDMA is used in the treatment of PTSD in the context of psychotherapy for a couple of different reasons. So when we look at what MDMA does in the brain, MDMA does several things. One, it causes a large release of serotonin, which is probably what in recreational use creates a pleasurable kind of pro-social feeling. You know, people on MDMA tend to want to be around other people. They feel talkative sometimes. They feel close to other people. That is also probably accounted for by the fact that the drug causes a release of a compound called prolactin and another compound in the body called oxytocin. And all three of these chemicals together, which are naturally occurring chemicals in the body and brain, the release of them is increased by MDMA. Now, why would that have any value in therapy, you might be wondering.
Right. How'd you know my next question? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So in people with PTSD often have a lot of difficulty with feeling safe, which makes sense because, you know, we can think about PTSD as the brain is struggling to feel safe because there was a time in that person's life when they felt profoundly unsafe, profoundly in danger. And so we can think about PTSD as a kind of being stuck in that state, not through any lack of will or interest. I mean, Lord knows people with PTSD would love not to feel that way, but the brain really just doesn't buy it. You know, and Bessel van der Kolk has talked about this kind of resides in the body, that the body really needs to feel safe in order for trauma to be processed, which makes a lot of sense. And so one of the things that happens in people with PTSD is that a structure of the brain called the amygdala. So the brain you can kind of think of as like a three-layer cake. You've got your brain stem on the bottom, in the middle layer is something called the limbic system, and then the top is that crinkly part we call the cortex. So the amygdala is in that middle section, something called the limbic system, which sits on top of the brain stem, and its job is really, it's kind of like airport security. So everything coming into the brain, just like if you want to get on a flight anywhere in this country, you've got to go through airport security. There's no way around it. And so if you want to get information into the brain, you've got to go past the amygdala. And the amygdala works like airport security to pick up threats, right? And so just like airport security, most information coming in the brain is not a threat. There's not, you know, it's just day-to-day life. And just like most 99.9% of passengers going through airport security do not represent a threat. So the airport security and the amygdala have this difficult job. They need to pick out the occasional threat that comes through. The problem is that after somebody's experienced a trauma, a lot of times the amygdala really becomes oversensitive. So it kind of becomes like, you know, if you've ever had a smoke detector that goes off every time you cook dinner, you know, it's like right. that, you know, the house is not actually on fire, but this little box on your ceiling doesn't quite understand that. And so it's making a racket and thinking that the house is on fire. Well, somebody with PTSD, that alarm system becomes very sensitive. Perhaps too sensitive. And so what that looks like is people have an exaggerated startle response. They have difficulty kind of settling in and feeling safe and comfortable. And what MDMA seems to do is it seems to turn that area of the brain down for the duration of the drug effect. At the same time, it's also increasing activity in this area right behind your eyebrows called the prefrontal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex is a really important part of the brain because it helps to it's really where we think about a lot of things. It's where we make sense out of things. We make a story. We make decisions. And so normally the prefrontal cortex would say to the amygdala, you know, hey, that noise that you just heard in the other room is actually not anybody coming in to harm you. It's the cat knocked, you know, something over or something like that. But so somebody has PTSD, they hear that noise and they startle because the amygdala is oversensitive and the prefrontal cortex can't weigh in and say, oh, that's nothing to worry about. That's neutral. So what's this all got to do with therapy, right? So people with PTSD in therapy often struggle with either one of two extremes. So they either feel totally overwhelmed by therapy and they feel flooded by it. And so they can't tolerate it, or they can't engage in it because it doesn't feel safe. And so there's a very narrow, what's known as a window of tolerance for therapy with people with PTSD. It makes a lot of people with PTSD not seek therapy because they don't want to talk about the traumatic event because it makes them upset. Right. And so what MDMA appears to do is to sort of widen that window of tolerance so that people can not only talk about the traumatic event, but they can feel some at least brief embodied sense of safety. I'm thinking about a patient of mine who went through MDMA therapy, who's, you know, when I asked her about it, she said it was the first time she had ever felt safe in her life, felt physically safe. So you get that opportunity to really process trauma. And the other valuable component to therapy is that a lot of people with PTSD have difficulty trusting, particularly if the trauma was interpersonal in nature, as many traumas are, you know, another human being caused you harm. Right. And so, you know, rather than, you know, a hurricane or an earthquake or something, you know, this is somebody, another human being harmed you. And that makes it difficult to trust. And so the oxytocin and prolactin aspects of MDMA are interesting in that these are hormones that are released when we bond as human beings. So oxytocin is often associated with breastfeeding because it is released by both mother and infant during breastfeeding. And it facilitates what we call mammalian pair bonding. But really that feeling of like, I trust you, I feel close to you. I can talk to you. And so that, as you can, is pretty obviously advantageous in psychotherapy. And so that's why we think that MDMA has this beneficial effect in sort of catalyzing the psychotherapy process. Because the psychotherapy happens, it's also important to remember that the psychotherapy happens not only during the drug session, but before and after. So the drug session is bookended by many hours of therapy, both before the actual drug session and also afterwards in what we call integration psychotherapy, where once the drug session is over, you know, many days or even weeks later, you're talking with those same two therapists that you went through the drug session with, because you've got these two people in the room with you the whole time. And you're talking about what came out of that session, what emotions you experienced, perhaps what things came to mind for you, and probably most importantly, how you want to try and do things differently in the future.
And I imagine that that is incredibly powerful, especially for somebody who had some sort of trauma in childhood and has an experience where they've never felt safe, to get that window of that experience and know what that feels like in your body. And you know, neuroplasticity is such a buzzword right now, but in creating these neural pathways, if you've never had that or haven't been able to connect with it as an adult, right. To have that window as an anchor of like, oh, this is what's possible. This is how it's possible to feel through doing this kind of work. And eventually, like, it's not like a switch that, you know, now you're safe, I'm sure,
right.
But
right.
through
right.
continued exposure, through continued modalities of therapy, through continued, this continued treatment, that you're going to get more and more able to kind of anchor into that, I imagine.
Exactly. Because, you know, one of the things that is being looked at a lot in psychedelic therapy is the acceptance and commitment therapy model, ACT. And so in ACT, there's this idea that a lot of our mental health problems, if you will, emerge from something called experiential avoidance, which is essentially saying, no, I'm not going to feel that. I'm not going to think that. I'm not going to go there. Right. And by doing that, you know, I mean, that's an obvious problem in, say, somebody who has a phobia, you know, who is afraid of going out in public because, well, you know, before the pandemic, you know, you had to go get groceries at least, right? Now you can have them delivered to you. But it can have more subtle and sort of insidious effects if somebody refuses to feel an emotion, for example. And so I think a lot of people with trauma often actively, as a evolved way of keeping themselves safe. You know, it's not that they wake up in the morning and say, I'm not going to let myself feel any strong feelings. It's just, this is what allows them to function and feel safe. They get this brief moment of like, what if you felt all the feelings and it was okay? And you know, the drug wears off and they go back to what we would call an ordinary state of consciousness. But I think there's something really valuable about that kind of touchstone experience. I have this little pin here. This is a little stylized map of Barcelona. And I have this because I went to Barcelona about 25 years ago, and I can still conjure Barcelona in my mind. I haven't been back in 25 years. I'd like to get back one of these days, but I've never been back. But I can kind of conjure down to the details of like, what did the ocean smell like, and what did, you know, the sound on the streets. I can bring that to mind, and it's kind of a touchstone place. And I think for people who are struggling with, be it trauma or depression, to have even a transient moment where they think, oh, this is what it could be like, is very powerful, because it allows you to see that it is possible. And now you go back to your ordinary state of consciousness, and you may not feel that way when you get back there, but you know that it's possible. And then it becomes sort of a North Star, if you will, to keep kind of orienting yourself back towards. So it's important, despite the way the media sort of tends to cover this as this sort of like one and done kind of treatment, it's more complicated than that. it's more complicated. And you know, we love a quick fix in this culture. You know, we love something that's going to make something go away right away. Poof, you're all better. And yeah. You know, that I think is one of the risks that psychedelics run, is that people will see them as this quick fix. You know, I get messages every week from people looking for this kind of treatment, you know, and I get it. You know, our treatments are really woefully inadequate. You know, it's better than nothing, but they leave a lot to be desired, and they give a lot of people side effects, and they don't work completely for many people. And so I fully understand the hunger for a treatment that's going to make this go away.
Right.
But it's important to understand that this is not a one and done kind of treatment, that there's a real process that's involved.
And you mentioned kind of media normalization of psychedelics, and it's often covered as recreational. And even when not done with recreation in mind, even when done with intention around trauma, it's often still, because of legalities, marketed and told, the stories are told as this, like, I went into the forest, I did this thing. I recently saw one about somebody that injected frog venom or something, and, you know, it cured me of all of my XYZ, right? And I can see how that would be really frustrating for someone like you who does this work and knows kind of the space that you're creating and the modality that you're creating and just all of the therapy and instruction and all of it that's involved to get someone from A to B truly in a way that's going to last and have a real changing effect on their life.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've often thought about that psychedelic journeys are, particularly when they have that kind of intention, they're similar to that Jungian idea of the hero's journey. You know, and we love hero's journey stories in our culture. You know, they're
really neat,
you know,
and tidy, and
yeah, you know, Star Wars, right? You know, one day Luke is farming, you know, on that desert planet, and then the next day he's blowing up the Death Star, and then he's, you know, back to regular life. And you know, and you forget all the sort of trials and tribulations and challenges that happen between that departure from ordinary life and that reemergence back to ordinary life. And you know, that can be a very transformative experience, but it needs to be held with a lot of care. And I think that's one of the, you know, you have to understand that psychedelics are deeply contextual. And by that, I mean we talk a lot about this idea of set and setting, which refers to mindset and physical setting. But then there's this third component that sometimes people call matrix or context, which is really the story about the drugs in the larger context, the larger culture. So, you know, in the 1960s, they were this sort of bacchanalia liberation agent, right? That this was going to, you know, change, tune in, turn out, drop out, you know, that kind of narrative. And then in the 70s and 80s, when I was coming of age, they were these dangerous drugs that would cause you to lose your mind. And now the story is that there are these miracle cures, because we have people like Michael Pollan and Anderson Cooper talking about them in popular media. And of course, they've got everyone's ears perked up. And there's a temptation to think like, oh, this is just like Prozac or something. You just take the pill and get the effect. And it's further complicated by, you know, there's millions of Americans who've had recreational psychedelic experiences. You know, most people don't talk about it in mixed company because of this sort of social stigma around drug use. But, you know, the epidemiologic data would show that there's, you know, there's millions of people that have had these experiences. And many of them would tell you that they were interesting or maybe even powerful, but they may not necessarily be therapeutic if they're not held with that intention. You know, so the idea that really needs to be a specific intention and the support and resources around the person for them to be able to have that experience. And just taking, you know, MDMA at a festival is not necessarily going to result in this experience. If anything, it can sometimes be really challenging if those emotional issues are right beneath the surface. And then all this sort of energy that we put into holding that flood wall back is gone. Then sometimes people can feel really overwhelmed. I mean, I've worked in harm reduction at Burning Man and at a big you know, festival and you know, at a place called the Zendo, and we would have people coming in all the time who, you know, thought they were going to go out and have a good night dancing or whatever, and, you know, ended up unexpectedly remembering when their mother died when they were 6 years old. I mean, they it's not that they'd forgotten it, but that was not their intention.
But a visceral,
they had a very visceral kind of grief experience. And, you know, that evening turned into a very different thing, you know, not necessarily a bad thing, but certainly was not what they expected.
Right. And yeah, I heard you say a lot of things, and I'm so glad that you brought up kind of the recreational use and the way people expect, like they expect to, with just their intention, be able to control their response. And that's so often not the case. I mean, so many of us have things that we're holding at bay. And I've heard dozens of stories of that exact same kind of thing happening to people where they had an expectation about what the result was going to be. And it was turned out very, very different and almost further traumatizing or similar experiences.
Yeah, it can be. I think a lot of times what people sometimes refer to as bad trips, which is a term that we don't usually use in the research world. Even in the harm reduction world, we normally talk about things as being challenging experiences, right? You know, because there's so much sort of fear around having a bad trip. But I think a lot of times what people refer to as bad trips are actually sort of their grief experiences. You know, and this is something I'm working on. I'm starting to draft a book around this, is around grief and psychedelics, because I think a lot of times what comes out for people, and I think this is a really important part of trauma work, is experiencing grief. That, you know, that trauma really often robs us of parts of our lives, be that our childhood or be that our ability to feel safe in the world or to feel comfortable in a relationship. You know, trauma can be a really insidious thief, and people often have a lot of grief around that. And that often is one of the things that emerges in psychedelic sessions, which is fine. You know, again, this is one of those things that people are often avoiding feeling. And if the psychedelic experience allows them access to it, that can be very healing, but it needs to be handled with a lot of care and a lot of caution.
Absolutely. So let's speak about kind of the caution, right? Because psychedelic drugs, for people who haven't recreationally used them or haven't known anyone who's recreationally used them, sound super scary and illegal. And so let's kind of talk about that context. And I don't want anybody to misinterpret that us talking about it means that it's free and available all over the place for anyone to do that chooses.
Yeah. So it's important to, you know, we're talking about this as if these are available at your local Walgreens, you know, which of course they're not. So these still remain what we call Schedule I drugs under the Controlled Substance Act, which means that they are illegal to possess outside of a research context. And that their safety has not been sort of endorsed by the Food and Drug Administration. So the current clinical trials, which I've been working on, are working towards that. You know, we're working towards showing that there's evidence that these drugs in this particular context are effective, and that no drug is 100% safe. But some drugs, you have a better understanding of what the safety issues are than others. And, you know,
and I'm sure sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I'm sure that also includes the context of manufacturing and control of the substance, right?
Right. So one of the inherent challenges of using a drug that is illegal is that it inherently comes from the black market. And, you know, the black market is an unregulated place, and there has been adulteration of drugs and such. And so just starting with safety, you know, when people take a white powder that is supposedly MDMA, they generally don't know where it came from, and they don't know how pure it is, and they don't know if it's contaminated with other substances. And so there's an inherent risk that comes with that. You know, of course, there's also the legal risk that comes with just possession, which can be, you know, grounds for being charged under the law. And that is its own kind of harm, because, you know, if you have a drug possession charge on your record, you know, that's going to create a lot of problems in your life. And so, you know, the drug war and prohibition has created its own harms. And, you know, arguably the black market is a result of drug prohibition, because, you know, it creates this underground marketplace, which is not regulated. And so the safety, so what we're looking to do with these studies is to really understand what are the benefits and what are the risks. And, you know, if the FDA feels like those are reasonable and on balance, then they will approve this as a treatment. But you have to understand that this is probably never going to be a treatment that you go down to your local drugstore to pick up. You know, this is not right. going to be like a prescription of Zoloft. You know, this is going to be something that is more akin to a, you know, surgical procedure, right? Where, you know, you if you go in for a colonoscopy or something, you know, you are given certain drugs in the context of a hospital. And right. those aren't things that you take at home. And so, you know, this will be more akin to that if things go forward as they seem to be right now.
What does the timeline look like on that?
So we're looking probably at MDMA is for PTSD is in what they call middle late phase three. So there's three phases to approving a drug. The FDA requires the phase three, the large controlled studies. And so the first half of that was published earlier this year. The second half is underway. If everything continues to go well and the effects continue to be as impressive as they were in the first half, probably 2023. For MDMA, psilocybin, which I haven't talked much about yet, we're looking at that more for major depression, and that's probably a couple of years behind that. It's a little further along in the research process. So probably looking, you know, maybe 2025. You know, if I had to just spitball it.
Okay, I mean, obviously you're not in control of that, but I love that you spitballed it.
Don't quote me.
Exactly, right? I'm going to hold you accountable.
There's so many things that slow it down, and certainly COVID didn't help the process because, you know, these studies are done, you know, in a comfortable little living room like environment with three people sitting in it. And obviously you can't do that when there's a respiratory disease floating around. So,
right.
You know, we had to put a lot of things on pause
on hold.
for a year. Yeah.
So as a psychiatric nurse practitioner, like what perspective does nursing bring to this whole thing and the environment in which you're practicing?
Yeah, so one of the things that's sort of a really active question is, first of all, if these things are FDA approved, what will the FDA require in terms of a therapeutic container? And this is where it gets a little tricky because the FDA really, you know, as a federal agency that is tasked with overseeing the safety and efficacy of drugs, really doesn't know much about psychotherapy. Mm. You know, that's not right. that's not their wheelhouse, right?
Right.
And so it's not there. So most drugs are just approved as the drug itself, and then it's up to individual providers to decide whether or not it's appropriate and medically indicated to prescribe that drug
based on the individual and
totally and their clinical judgment and all that right. goes into that. So the question is, will the FDA mandate the type of therapy that goes into this treatment? Will they and if they do that, will they mandate what type of clinicians can be that therapist? Assuming that they do mandate a therapeutic container, who will they get into that kind of granular detail of what qualifications? Will the person need to be a psychiatrist or psychologist or marriage family therapist? Right. You know, we don't know. We don't really know. But as a nurse, as a nurse practitioner, I'm particularly interested in the perspective of nursing and what nursing brings to this, because I think nurses are really actually very well suited to delivering psychedelic therapy because, you know, these are long days. You know, a therapy session day is 6 to 9 hours. It's not a 50 minute session. It's an all day session.
Right.
And you're with somebody who is, potentially in a non-ordinary state of consciousness, you know, so they might be crying, they might be, you know, thrashing about, you know, there's all sorts of different, you know, they might be very silent for many hours. I've seen that happen too. And you know, that's not all that different than being in an ICU. You know,
right.
so
yeah,
when
yeah.
you're when you're doing a shift in an ICU, you're there
and
for
an 8 or 12
hours
because of other drugs. Yeah,
with
yeah.
people who are, you know, because of their illness, because of their injury, in an altered state of consciousness. But more and more to the point, nurses are really good at meeting patients where they're at, and and really holding the care aspect of things. You know, we often get kind of enamored with cure in medicine, and nurses are really more focused on the process of care. And and really, you know, when we talk about holding space, you know, that's sort of a popular term, you know, and I always, you know, want to ask people, what do you mean by that? You know, what do you mean? What does it mean to hold space? You know, and there's this very core idea in psychedelic therapy that we have an inner healer. We have an innate capacity to heal if we can make conditions for that person to heal. They know how to heal. You know, I mean, Florence Nightingale talked about this 150 years ago, that you know, what the body knows how to heal. You need to get the wound clean in order for the wound to heal, but we can't make the wound heal. We can make the conditions for the wound to heal ideal. And psychologically, I think that is an appropriate metaphor here, because, you know, a lot of many of us will experience trauma in our lives. I mean, we know that trauma is incredibly common. And the good news, you know, that's the bad news. The good news is that the vast majority of people who experience trauma actually don't develop PTSD, which, you know, I think always surprises people with PTSD, because they assume that everyone who experiences trauma gets PTSD, and that's actually not the case. And so what it tells me is that there is this innate ability to heal, but that maybe people with PTSD have not been able to get there. You know, maybe there's still kind of dirt in the wound, if you will, that needs to be cleaned out in order for that sort of natural healing to occur. And that's really what a lot of what we're doing with psychedelics, and that's a lot of what we're doing in nursing, is we're making the conditions right for the person to get better, and for that innate healing, inner healer, if you will, to emerge. And so that's why I think nursing is really well suited to this. And you know, people trust nurses. You know, we're kind of with people, you know, through childbirth, through death, through, you know, that moment that you're in the ER and you're scared because you can't breathe, you know, like, the nurses are there. And so I think nurses are sort of a natural fit for this work.
You said so much that I loved and agreed with. And one of the things that you touched on was about trauma, what we know about trauma, and so much of, especially what Gabor Mate says about trauma, is about how the trauma is not what happened to you. It's what happened after what happened to you, and the way that you were kind of cared for and held, and how people reacted to your trauma, right? And so I imagine, and you can speak to this much more well than I can because you're in these rooms, but that in that holding space thing that we're talking about, that having someone being able to go through your having that safety, you know, putting the guard away so that your security is taking a nap, if you will, and being somewhere where security was taking a nap and you're kind of dealing with your trauma, and you were safe, like, and that the person that was with you was able to stay in the room with you literally and not be reactionary and not be triggered and not make it their own, and all of the things that we accidentally do to exacerbate people's traumatic experiences.
Right.
That's got to be really powerful. And that's what I think of when I think of holding space, for sure.
Absolutely. And another therapeutic modality that's been used a lot, particularly with MDMA therapy, is internal family systems. And, you know, Dick Schwartz's work with internal family systems and creating that modality, this idea that we have these protector parts, which really, you know, you have to, there's a saying, you know, you have to get permission of the protector part in order to get into the other stuff. You know, and it's only when, so it's not like we're, you know, kind of putting ether over the protector part, you know, and knocking it out. You know, it's not like some spy caper or something like that. You know, it's really that we're, the therapeutic work is so important in order to establish that kind of trust. And so that's why we put so much time in beforehand in order for people to feel okay to feel whatever comes up. You know, we talk about being trusting, letting go, being open to whatever emerges. And, you know, a lot of times in those preparatory psychotherapy sessions, people ask questions like, well, what if I panic? You know, or what if I get really scared? And we say, well, what if you did? you know, instead of saying, oh no, that won't happen because, you know, right. the protector part's not buying that, right? You know, so it, we say, well, what if you did, you know, could that be okay? You know, Tara Brach talks about, and this too, you know, could that be okay? Could it be okay to have a panic attack with us? You know, knowing that we will keep you safe, knowing right. that you're not going to die. You're going to be okay. It's going to be uncomfortable. It might be really miserable for a little while. You know, I want right. to be really clear that, you know, these psychedelic therapy sessions are not all rainbows and electronic dance music. You know, like this is hard work. You know, people come out of these sessions and they are drained, and the therapists are drained too, because, you know, you would think sitting in a chair for 8 hours in a little room with somebody who's largely silent would not take up that much energy. You're tired when you come out of these sessions, you know, which is one of the reasons why I think doing this therapy probably won't be for everyone, because, you know, some people would actually rather see five people for 50 minutes in a work day, you know, than sit with one person for 8 or 9 hours who might go through a right. whole range of emotional experiences.
And if we can get into the weeds on the treatment just a little bit, sure. in a typical, let's say a day of treatment, how much of that is kind of the pre-work and how much of that is actually having, you know, administered drugs? And then how much of that is kind of the recovery and integration part that you were talking about?
Yeah. So on the MDMA study that I worked on, the phase 3 study, I'm doing this off the top of my head, but I believe we had 12 non-drug therapy sessions, and we had three drug, or because it's a clinical trial, or placebo sessions that was randomized and double blinded. So the therapist nor the subject knew if they got drug or placebo, although most people tend to know. Not surprisingly. Yeah. It's blinding is a real challenge.
Yeah.
Blinding is a real challenge in clinical trials. But so before the first drug session, there were 3 90-minute sessions of psychotherapy with the same 2 therapists who were there through the entire process. And in those sessions, you know, we talk about what they're hoping for, you know, and we also encourage people to hold those expectations kind of lightly, because, you know, there's a sort of an adage around psychedelics that they are kind of tricksters, you know, that they... that you don't necessarily get what you want, you get what you needed. So a lot of it is about expectation management and encouraging people to remain open, because, you know, sometimes people come out of these sessions, and this is very common with the sort of anecdotes, is that they thought they were going to go into work on one thing and ended up looking at something totally different. And that was fine. But if they had gone in thinking, you know, this is the thing I must look at, they would end up being disappointed. So we encourage people to be open to whatever emerges. So then on the day of the actual dosing, you know, we usually have a preparation session the day before, immediately the day before. And, you know, the person tries out our couch, you know, our lab looks like a little living room. We have soft lights and, you know, comfortable furniture, and there's a couch that we make into a kind of a day bed on the day of the session so they can lie down.
That's nice, but it's not super clinical.
No, it looks, we really try to go out of our way to make it not look like a hospital. And I like to say it looks like a funky Airbnb. So we have a set of eye shades that people will put on, which we do that to encourage them to have inward focus. You know, we tell people your job is not to entertain us. You know, you don't need to talk with us unless you feel compelled to. We will check in with you every hour if you're not talking, just to make sure you're okay. And we also have music, and music is a really important part of psychedelic therapy. So we have it usually on headphones and available to play in the room. And it's a preset selection of music. It varies in its qualities. You know, it's often kind of expansive and what they call tonal music, you know, which is different. I mean, the older studies tended to use more Western classical music, and more recent years there's been more of a shift towards, you know, Brian Eno type of what might be called ambient music or tonal music. But it varies, you know, some of it can be kind of more rousing, especially more percussive, especially when we get towards the sort of peak drug effects, which usually come about 90 minutes to 120 minutes in. You know, we want people to feel a certain amount of kind of energy, you know, for the work. And we encourage people to use the music almost like a current in a stream, you know. So it's like, just let the music carry you forward. And that music is often very powerful. You know, people have very strong associations with the music. The one subject I'm thinking of actually found similar music and would use it to meditate afterwards because it was so evocative of the feelings that he had during the therapy session. So he's able to
make kind of that association and the safety and all.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of just conditioned response to openness. And so we start, early in the morning. Usually somebody comes in at 8 or 9 in the morning. Have them ingest the drug by mid morning, typically, and then ask them to settle in. And we're there the whole day, depending on the drug, with, you know, both MDMA and psilocybin have a duration of effect of about 5 or 6 hours. And so as the drug begins to wear off, people kind of come back to their more ordinary state of consciousness. We're taking vital signs throughout the whole process. That's part of our study protocol. If they need to use the bathroom, you know, we walk them to the bathroom, make sure that they're safe, that they don't stumble or anything like that. And then once they're safe to go home, well, on the MDMA study, they stayed overnight in the lab, and then we would meet with them the next morning. In our current study on psilocybin, they go home with a trusted person, and then we meet with them the next day. And then that after therapy, the integration therapy is really critical, because that's when people really begin to put the experience together. You know, it's a little bit of a misnomer to call it psychedelic assisted therapy, because a lot of times during the drug session, they're not actually doing a lot of talking.
Right.
It can vary. You know, some people can be fairly chatty, but we often actually encourage people to put their focus more inward and not feel the need to be conversant, and we'll do the talking afterwards. And so we ask people to really attend to their inner world. And then afterwards, we end up having some really interesting conversations about what they experienced, what they felt, and how they begin to put it together with the rest of their life. Because that's, you know, this is another thing where it's different than recreational psychedelic use. Because a lot of times when people have a psychedelic experience, they kind of chalk it up to like, well, that was interesting, but weird. And I don't know what to do with that.
Right.
And it just becomes kind of a, you know, a dinner party story of like, oh, this time in college when I took acid, you know, and instead of like, oh, this was a really important experience that changed the way I thought about something, you know. And a lot of times what people often will come to a realization is that they have often been very hard on themselves, you know, so there's often an element of self-compassion that emerges. And sometimes people also realize how they've also been a participant in their own unhappiness, you know, how they've engaged in patterns which sort of perpetuate maybe a core belief that is actually not beneficial to them anymore. And so part of the integration therapy is to talk about how do they want to do differently in the future? You know, what might they
do? What are they ready to let go of?
Exactly. And so, so there's a lot of that, and also allowing people to experience grief, as I mentioned before, is often very healing. You know, many people with trauma are carrying a tremendous amount of grief, and just to allow themselves to feel that is something some often they haven't allowed themselves to do before.
I bet. Before we wrap up, I want to ask you about what you know about kind of the state of these types of studies worldwide in other places other than the US.
Yeah. So there's sort of the psychedelic universe seems to be expanding by the week, especially as different companies have gotten into this. There are two major players in the psilocybin for depression sphere. So the USONA Institute, which is a study I'm working on, is based here in the United States, which is a nonprofit organization trying to bring psilocybin to market at cost. And then the Compass Pathways is a British company that is a for-profit company that is also engaged in clinical trials for depression. So both of those, if successful, would seek approval definitely in the US through the FDA and in Europe through the European Medicine Association. And then MDMA is being sponsored by the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS, which would be applying for approval in both in Europe and both Canada and the United States, if successful. So that's sort of where the research is at. But then there's a lot of other companies looking at novel molecules or looking at these for other indications. So there's a lot of different things emerging. And then, of course, there's the whole decriminalization movement, which we haven't really talked about, such as like in Oregon. There was an initiative passed last year that will move a system forward where people can obtain psilocybin who don't necessarily have a psychiatric or palliative care is the other area which we haven't really touched on, where psychedelics have there's been a lot of research looking at particularly psilocybin at end of life. Could that be something that helps people with existential distress and anxiety that they may have around a life-threatening diagnosis? There were a couple of really important papers that were published in 2016 out of Johns Hopkins and NYU that looked at that very question and found very promising results. And so that's a whole nother area is palliative care, where these medicines could probably very well be deployed. So there's a lot happening in the sphere right now, and it's kind of hard to keep up with all of it, but it's very, very interesting.
And I want to ask you one more question, because you said just one thing that I didn't understand, which was novel molecule, and I just want to circle back. I just need to put a pin in that. What? Excuse me?
Sure. So novel molecules would be basically variations on a theme. And so you take a drug. So one that some people in the audience might know about would be ketamine, and a newer drug called esketamine. So esketamine is essentially just a variation on ketamine, and it's really not that different than ketamine, but it was patentable and it was approved by the FDA as a depression treatment for depression. So a lot of these drugs, they are kind of they lend themselves to minor substitutions in the molecular structure, which would potentially give the drug different effects. There's a very well-known chemist. He's passed now, named Alexander Shulgin, Sasha Shulgin, who was really the person who resynthesized MDMA in the early 1970s, he was a famous Dow chemical chemist who had a backyard hobby of tinkering around with drugs like MDMA and tryptamines to see doing exactly that, substituting one molecule for another and seeing what effects it had by ingesting very small quantities himself to see to understand the effects of them. And so there may be compounds out there, beyond MDMA and psilocybin that could also have therapeutic effects that are in the same kind of family as those drugs, but that are really not well known or not really yet investigated. So there's a lot of sort of research interest in this field at this time. This whole idea of really taking something that only needs to be taken once or twice, or maybe that may be a little too ambitious to think of sort of one and done, but maybe that somebody has this treatment once a year or twice a year or something like that, but doesn't have to take a drug like an antidepressant
every day
like they do now.
Absolutely fascinating work. Andrew, I'm so thankful for your time. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. This has been fun.
And if somebody wants to find out more about you or your work, where would they best do that?
Yeah, they can go to my website, which is andrewpennnp.com. And also for nurses who are interested in this work, I co-founded an organization called the Organization of Psychedelic and Entheogenic Nurses, which is openurses.org.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.